across Northeast Dublin.
90.3.
This is Near FM.
I am joined now by another man well known to listeners to Near FM, John Dorney. John, good morning. Welcome to the programme.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Donny.
John, very timely, I would suggest, from a political stance. Now, I know this is a historical look at things, but from a political stance, a book on the Irish Civil War in Dublin from 1922 to 1924. It really, really was a ferociously turbulent time. And maybe I have a feeling, Pat, as somebody who was huge, or sorry, Pat John, as somebody who's huge into history, that, you know, there was a massive, massive sort of the way history was maybe taught in school years ago. Oh, the struggle against the British was brilliant and we did so well and we drove them out after 800 years and all this. Yeah, when it came to the Civil War, there was a lot of it airbrushed out and swept under the carpet, never again to be talked about.
Yeah, definitely there was a lot of that. One of the interesting things that I found when I was researching the book was that family memory also got changed, though. So it wasn't just a case of, you know, a plan by someone at the top. So what you'd often find is people would have a photo on the wall, and I'm thinking of some specific examples here of someone who was killed back then, and the family story would have been that they were killed fighting the Black and Tans, and it turned out that they were killed in the Civil War, you know, on one side or the other. And there's a memorial also near where I'm from in Milltown in South Dublin, and like that, I mean, everyone locally said it was a memorial to someone who was killed in an ambush of the Black and Tans, and it turned out that no, he was killed just after Christmas of 1922 in a revenge killing. So a pro-treaty politician, Seamus Dwyer, was assassinated in Rathmines, and this man, Frank Lawler, was taken out to Milltown and he was shot dead in reprisal. And the Civil War is like that. I think it's not just a case of a plot. I think it's people found it very difficult to make sense of it afterwards and really just wanted to forget it. So the memory became very distorted over time, yes.
Now, I mean, I said that it was very topical and timely, a book like this, because, you know, out of that, I suppose, came the treaty and the anti-treaty and pro-treaty, which basically, as time evolved, basically, I suppose, turned into Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Even though the very first government in the history of the state, I think, was the Sinn Féin government, but that sort of evolved into this Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael party lines that continued up until, I suppose, we saw a softening of that with the confidence and supply issue in recent years, and then we have them in full coalition now. Was the bitterness and what happened that time, John, was it really that bad that it took 100 years for them to be able to sort of realign again?
Well, yes and no, you know, to give a classic hedging answer. So one thing I'd say to start off with is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are only partly products of the Civil War. So there's 10 years in between the Civil War and what really the party system that we knew it for the most of the 20th century forming, and a lot happened in that time. So Fianna Fáil came out of the anti-treaty tradition, yes, but Fianna Fáil left the IRA basically in 1926, and they concentrated on things that people were very concerned about in terms of land redistribution, so you know, dividing up land, in terms of building social housing, which is of course a big issue again today, as well as things like revising the treaty, so getting rid of the Oath of Allegiance and the Governor General and getting back the treaty ports, and talking about partition, which of course they never eventually got to, and so on. And in that period of time also, Cumann na n-Éill, as it then was, talked about themselves as the party of law and order, the party of the treaty, yes, but the party representing constitutionalism and law and order and electoral politics and so on. And they would depict their opponents as dangerous radicals, and sometimes they'd call them communists, which is hard to believe that somebody called Eamon de Valera a communist once, but they did. And you know, the political positions built up over that time. So it's not just the Civil War, it's stuff that came afterwards when people campaigned also on the bread and butter issues of that time. And famously also, there's another kind of second round of the Civil War, almost as far as in the 30s, which is the Blue Shirt period, where Fianna Fáil came to power and the pro-treatyites, or the people in Cumann na n-Éill, certainly thought that their rights might be suspended, that there might be some sort of a dictatorship or some sort of a revolution, and they formed the Armoury Comrades Association, which later became the Blue Shirts. Now, it's nothing like the Civil War in terms of violence, but there are riots around the country and stuff like that, and a lot of the bitterness builds up with things like that, very local things like who gets the job in local councils and so on like that. But I don't think that the Civil War bitterness as such lasted 100 years, no. I mean, what happened was you had a stabilisation of politics in the 1930s. The two big parties, which did come out of the Civil War and the National Movement before that, managed to kind of monopolise a lot of the politics, and it broke down in those terms, in terms of how power was distributed between them afterwards. I don't think, as the veterans of the Civil War aside, that people were still voting on the Civil War by, say, the 1950s. You know, I think that the Civil War itself had largely passed into history by that point.
And would that be true, John, throughout the country? Now, I know we're going to really sort of zone in on Dublin, but, you know, I mean, if you go down to, I suppose, grassroots politics down the country, there is a lot of that went down through the generations, and you will hear maybe the previous generation now talking about it in, you know, when it comes up to election time. There's nearly always some incident thrown up by the older generation going back to those days. And, you know, you would wonder, has Civil War politics been completely, you know, consigned to the rubbish bin of history?
Yeah, no, it hasn't. And you're right. If you go down to Kerry, they'll talk about Ballyseedy, and they'll talk about Clashmeek and Cave and the various things that happened in the Civil War. People will talk about executions in Sligo. They talk about the Noble Six, who were six people who were executed by pro-treaty soldiers on Benbulben Mountain. Pro-treatyites will talk about the burning of houses and the murder of relatives, sometimes of politicians and so on. So it's not totally dead, you're right. But the other point that I was trying to make in my previous comment, and I kind of left out, is there is another side to Civil War politics, which is not just Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and that's the militant Republican tradition. And what you found is, up until recent times, you know, kind of purist Republicans, not so much the modern Sinn Féin party, but the more purist, let's say, factions, would still hold commemorations religiously, if that's the right word, of people who were killed in the Civil War in incidents which the general public wouldn't be aware of. Like, for example, there was an annual commemoration up in County Leitrim for a guy called Michael Coe, who was killed in Ballyconnell in February 1922, and his brother, who was later killed when they blew up his dugout, and they were commemorated in County Leitrim. You'll see people turning out in County Wexford, the site of an ambush in March 23 or April 23, when four anti-treatyites were killed, and so on. So it's definitely kept alive to a certain extent, in part, as you say, I think, as you're getting at, in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but also in the much more militant kind of Republican tradition, which really remembered very keenly the Civil War, and which, of course, to this day, doesn't consider the Irish state as legitimate at all, and that does date, of course, from the Civil War.
Now, John, we have discussed Sinn Féin and the sort of faded from the political scene for a long number of years, as you have stated. Okay, they're back now, front and centre. But for the bulk of the last 100 years, it has been the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael two-party system, really, with some of the smaller parties joining up with them in various coalitions along the way, when coalition governments became the order of the day. But let us take it back to the period that your book covers. And can I put a third rung under the stool, or a third leg under the stool, and ask you, what was the attitude of the Catholic Church to what was going on in Dublin at the time? Because, I mean, we are talking about a time when it was, I suppose, Holy Catholic Ireland.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, so the Catholic Church is obviously grew in power in the 19th century. You have this tradition in Dublin, though, of people who are Catholics who would go to Mass and who would be nationalist in politics, but would be kind of hostile to the Church. And this kind of goes back to the days of the Fenians, which was quite a big thing in Dublin in the late 19th century, and also the Parnell split. So the Church was against Parnell because they called Parnell an adulterer and a divorcee and so on, but Dublin nationalists were majority Parnellites. So what you see in the Civil War is, yes, the Catholic Church, which kind of hemmed and hawed during the War of Independence, so you have some bishops denouncing the IRA, notably in Cork in the War of Independence, but others kind of stay silent about it. In the Civil War, the Church comes out very forcefully in October 22, and it says that this is just a campaign of murder against the elected government of the Irish people, and that it's a sin, and the people who are doing it can't receive the sacraments, and so on. So they denounce.
And sorry, John, did we actually have excommunications going on in the Catholic Church at the time?
Well, I'm told by people who are experts on religious doctrine that it's not excommunication as such, but what they did was they refused them sacraments. So an anti-treatyites would come and they'd go for communion, and the priest said, "I can't give thee this because you're in defiance of the orders of the hierarchy." That absolutely happened, yeah, all around the country, and people were extremely bitter about that afterwards. So in Dublin, though, I mean, you do have this, like, as I said, slightly anti-clerical kind of aspect to nationalism and republicanism. And what a lot of people in Dublin, notably, for example, Todd Andrews, who wrote a very interesting memoir, who had a long career afterwards, wrote, was that it increased this bitterness and this sense of betrayal that we had about the Church, but it didn't really affect us politically. If that's true around the country, it's harder to say. I mean, I suspect it did affect people. But you see lots of incidents around the country where this is read out. And for example, in County Kerry in Tralee, a member of Cumann na mBan goes up in front of a priest and tears up this proclamation that they read out, and afterwards the priest puts a boycott on her, and then the IRA puts a boycott on the priest. So yes, it's Catholic Ireland, but there is quite a stark confrontation, and the Catholic Church isn't entirely convinced that they're winning this in the Civil War. They're very dismayed that a lot of people actually do defy them. So for example, in prison, the chaplains in the prison, and there's 12,000 people kept in prison, of course, in the Civil War. The chaplain would visit the prisoners and said, "I can't give you communion unless you renounce this terrible campaign you were involved in." And most of them don't. Like, some of them do, but most of them don't. So, odd as it might seem to us, in hindsight, the Church is not necessarily that confident that they won this particular round.
John, again, we'll talk now in more detail, I suppose, about the Dublin aspect of this, and maybe a little compare and contrast. How did things differ in Dublin from other parts of the country, now, other than the obvious geographical differences?
Well, in Dublin, first of all, the Civil War broke out in Dublin, as most people will be aware, with the bombardment of the forecourt. So there's a standoff for several months before the Civil War. Then finally, the provisional government opened fire in the forecourts, and there's significant fighting in Dublin for a week. There's about 80 people, by my count, killed, and several hundred wounded. And the anti-treaty forces that take a terrible blow there. They're not really prepared for it. They do very badly. They lose these positions. Several hundred of them are captured. Others of them disperse around the country. Then there's another incident in August where the anti-treatyites attempt to isolate Dublin. They attempt to destroy all the roads and the bridges leading into the city, and nearly 200 of them are captured in that incident as well, known as the Night of the Bridges in kind of Republican folklore of that era. But then afterwards, you do get quite a sustained guerrilla campaign in the city, so that isn't really well known, and this is what my book concentrates on. So you have, by my count, about 260 people killed in Dublin in the Civil War, and most of them, so two-thirds of them, are killed after the first week, which is all Dublin features in for most of the Civil War. Now, how is Dublin different from the rest of the country? Well, first of all, it's an urban environment, so the guerrillas in places like, say, Sligo, Leitrim, Kerry, Mayo, West Cork, the other places where they're operating, are generally in remote rural areas. In Dublin, they're basically hiding in the city. They're using anonymity. They're not carrying weapons openly and so on. But in terms of political sympathy, the elections of 22 and 23 show, and many of the guerrillas say this, that the population is basically against them. There's only roughly 10% of the population vote for the anti-treatyites in the election of 22, and it actually increases in the election of 23, but nevertheless, it's certainly a minority at that point, and the guerrillas say you couldn't depend on people who you had depended on in the war against the British. You had to keep quiet. You had to use only safe houses that you knew. So that gives the Dublin campaign a special character. Now, the other thing about it is that the headquarters of both sides are actually based in Dublin. So obviously, the provisional government, or later the Free State government, and their army are based in Dublin, their commands. But so are the anti-treatyites. So Liam Lynch, the chief of staff of the anti-treaty IRA, spends most of the Civil War living secretly in Dublin. And this also gives things a special character, because much more than the rest of the country, the decisions that are made at the top, you immediately see them kind of happening in Dublin. So, for example, when the pro-treatyites, or when the Free State government or the provisional government decides to carry out executions, this is from November onwards, so to shoot prisoners by firing squad, this immediately happens in Dublin. There's four shot in Kilmainham Jail, November 22. And a reprisal for that right away, you see in Liam Lynch's reprisals. So Liam Lynch says any TD who voted for the murder bill, which is what he calls it, are to be killed and their houses are to be burned. Now, there's only one TD killed, but there's attempts to kill many more. But you see a lot of house burning that first of all breaks out in Dublin and then spreads around the country.
And the other side of it, and I presume it still holds true today, if you have an organised army, urban warfare, an organised army can never win in an urban situation.
Yeah, but they kind of did, though, in the Civil War. So, you know, first of all, you know, in the stand-up fighting or conventional fighting of the first week of the Civil War in Dublin, the use of artillery and armoured vehicles basically meant that the pro-treaty side won reasonably easily, and this is true in Dublin and also in other urban places where fighting happened, such as Limerick and Waterford cities. In terms of the urban guerrilla thing, you know, winning is, of course, a relative term, so they basically reduced the anti-treaty campaign to a very low level by the time they called it off, which is in May of 23. And by that time, so you had roughly something like in the region of 3,000 members of the IRA, anti-treaty IRA in Dublin. And by that time, the vast majority of them are in jail. So the account, the auditing kind of that the anti-treatyites did at the end shows that they have 250 people still at large in Dublin at the end of the Civil War. But between them, they've only around 50 weapons they have to share and a small amount of explosives. So, yeah, they didn't quite eliminate them. So there's still the odd incident happening in Dublin by the end of the Civil War, but they very much got on top of them, actually. I think the key thing there is, as I said, that the majority population in Dublin was on their side, or at least neutral on their side, which is quite different, obviously, from other kind of urban insurrections that we know about.
John, did you find it sad? And I suppose it's the word that comes to mind, that you were writing about a situation and people, most of whom still have family members alive today, who, 2 years previously, 3 years previously, 4 years previously, were standing shoulder to shoulder fighting a common enemy, and here they were now killing one another in basically a war again.
Yeah, I mean, it's endlessly tragic and kind of futile. And often you look, you know, you leaf through casualties and you try to compile lists and so on, and the futility of it really strikes you, you know. The only thing I will say is that there were times when comradeship from before the truce, as they always called it, from the struggle against the British, actually saved people. And the example I always use is Ernie O'Malley. So Ernie O'Malley is this kind of charismatic guerrilla leader from the War of Independence. In the Civil War, he ends up as the anti-treaty commander in the Eastern Division. He's given kind of an administrator's job, which he hated, in Dublin. And he's finally captured out in this shootout on Aylesbury Road and Ball's Bridge, in this huge mansion of the Humphrey sisters. But O'Malley kills a soldier, he wounds several more in this shootout, and he's lying on the ground, and they're getting ready to finish him off. But an officer comes up and he goes, "No, that's O'Malley, you're not to shoot him." Then afterwards, O'Malley is wounded and he's in prison. And it's just at the time when they're starting all the executions in Dublin, and they shoot, for example, Erskine Childers, who's a senior Republican and who had been the secretary of the treaty negotiation. Now, in and around this time, December 22, and also, of course, they shot the four senior Republicans who they'd captured in the forecourts in December in reprisal for the assassination of Sean Hale's TD. At this time, Ernie O'Malley's mother, rights to Desmond Fitzgerald, as the father of Garrett, who we know from a later period, but he's Free State Minister at this time. And O'Malley's mother says to him, "Now you're to make sure that nothing happens to Ernie, because remember, it was you that recruited him into the Volunteers back in 1917. And Fitzgerald says, "Yeah, don't worry, nothing will happen to Ernie." No, so the ties of former comradeship didn't quite die in the Civil War, and they did save some people.
John, it's a fascinating period in Irish history, and you know, we here, even you know, chatting amongst ourselves, the 1916 commemoration, yeah, that's no problem, and that'll be a big fanfare and the whole lot. Remembering the Civil War, not so simple, is it?
No, not at all. And I mean, the thing about commemorating is it's about not so much laying out everything that happened, but putting meaning on it. And I think for the Rising, you know, I mean, there was talk, if you recall, during the centenary of the Rising about civilians killed and whether they should have launched the rebellion and so on. But the meaning people can put on the Rising today is the Rising was this bold stroke that ensured Irish independence. And most people, not everybody, but most people are comfortable with that. It's very difficult to put a meaning on the Civil War that people are comfortable with, to say it was worth it, or, you know, that it was basically worthwhile in any way. So you tend to just get back to polemic. You know, you get people from the pro-treaty tradition or who identify with the pro-treaty argument saying that this was the triumph of the rule of law over these anti-democratic fanatics and militarists, and you still hear this a lot. And from the other side, you know, what people usually fall back on, whether they're from the Fianna Fáil tradition or a more militant Republican tradition, is look at the cruel Free Staters, you know, look at the executions they carried out, the murders of the Republicans, and they say, you know, this is the Irish state, this wasn't the rule of law, this was just, you know, a British imposed tyranny and so on. So you very quickly fall back on the polemical arguments of one side or the other, but nobody seems really able to you know, gather a kind of a unifying meaning that the public wouldn't really latch onto. And so I'm not sure this is possible, but I will say, and I've always said about the Civil War, it happened, and if you leave it out of the study of the Irish Revolutionary period, you're just not going to understand, you know, how it ended or what its results were.
And I suppose, you know, on a totally detached and pragmatic way to finish it, John, you know, if you don't learn from the mistakes in your history, you are doomed to repeat them again. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot of things that still haven't been properly resolved and are bubbling away. So, I mean, if we don't learn from that period in our history, we're doomed to repeat it again.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that, Tony.
John, on a very important note, people wishing to get your book, how can they go about it?
Right, well, the book is published in 2017. It's republished again in 2022. You can get it in most bookshops, but you can also get it online from the publisher, which is Merrion Press, and you can also get it from Amazon.com or .co.uk.
Historian and well-known broadcaster John Dorney. John, thank you so much for joining me this morning. You're really one of those people that I could spend the entire day talking to, because I have a huge interest in it from when I was very young. But it was an absolute pleasure. And John, thank you for taking the time to talk to me on Northside Today this morning.
My pleasure, Tony.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Across North East Dublin.
90.3.
This is Near.